Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Community Conversations with your hosts, Phil Huff, and my co-host, Julie Calamine. How are you, Julie?
Well, Phil, I'm great, but I've been a little hot and a little bit inundated by smoke. How about you?
Yeah, well, a lot of that going around.
That's
hot,
for sure.
Hot and smoky, and it's been an interesting summer that way, and it's only the first part of August. So, you know, I think we'd be remiss to not recognize that there are a lot of people under more duress because of the smoke who are living in closer proximity to some of the fires and either have been evacuated or on that ready status. And so, you know, our hearts go out to the community who's enduring that, and also to seek the resources of friends of the community who are there to help.
Boy, that's really true, Phil. And you're staying out of the smoke, I hope.
As much as possible, although that did not preclude us from a little bit of huckleberry picking last weekend. And of course, a couple of the fabulous shows put on by the festival.
Yes, I made it to one. And Phil, the other thing we're not mentioning is that summertime is entertaining family and friends time in Sandpoint. And when I'm not dodging smoke and heat, it seems like that's all I've been doing.
Yeah, ours are coming up soon.
Yes, we love them, but it is that time. They're here.
They're here.
And well, anyway, it is a smoky time, and that means that it's a good time to be talking about what's happening with fire in our region. And later in the week, there's going to be more talk about fire prevention and fire prediction. But Phil, we've got a really interesting interview that's not quite as related to, well, it's related, but it's, I think, a little more interesting, Phil, and that's about
personal
fire
stories.
Spotting. Yeah, yep. More personal. And it's fire spotting in the Idaho Panhandle, and we are lucky enough to have Idaho Department of Lands Lookout Coordinator Pam Onan, and she's also a smoky helper. So hello, Pam.
Hi.
Hi, we're so happy to have you here today. Why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about your history in the area? You've lived here a long time, and then tell us how you came to be in Sandpoint and working as a fire spotter.
Well, it's a pretty long story, but mostly I came here because of the habitat and because of the land and because of the water, and probably for the same kind of reasons that a lot of people did. And that was a long time ago, as you say. And then at one point, I'd always kind of thought about being a lookout. I like being in the woods. I'd spent a lot of time in my native Minnesota canoeing and camping and being in the woods. And that's always been totally the most important thing for me. And so a friend of mine said, well, why don't you do that? And I said, well, I don't think they do it anymore. She says, oh yeah, they do. Oh, they call this. And then she named this fellow. He was a friend of ours, really good friend of hers. His name was Buzz. And so I called Buzz, and Buzz was a dispatcher on the Kinnexu at the Priest Lake Ranger District. And I said, my friend tells me I should call you about being a lookout. And he goes, well, yeah. I said, really? They still have them? And he goes, yeah. And I go, really? Okay, well, what do I do? And he says, well, we've got all ours hired for the year. And I went, oh. It was just like my balloon totally went away. But he said, you know, the state, I think they need somebody over there on the other side of the lake. And I went, oh, really? And I had no idea. So I dashed off. I called the state and they said, well, you have to have your resume in, the application in by noon. And so I was just a whirling dervish. You know, back then, I think we had fax. That was it, though. It's really a long time now. So I faxed off my application and I got an interview. And I was like, wow, really? I got an interview. I was so excited. I had no idea. So I went up into my interview, and it was really kind of, okay, cut me off if I'm going too long, but it was
okay.
So
we don't, we're gonna cut you off soon, but it's a good story.
Okay, so these funny guys were sitting there, they all had plaid shirts on and caps, baseball caps, and they interview me, and they each asked me a question, and it was mostly about if I could do a legal description, which I could. I'd been a paralegal for a long time, and you know, those deeds were nothing. So that was my interview, and then it was like, okay, I heard maybe I got the job, and I call up and I go, I talk to Buzz, and he goes, well, he called, nicest letter I ever got of rejection, which, you know, I'm not really good at rejection, but he goes, we hired this guy because he had, I don't know if he had a veteran's preference or something. And I was like, so disappointed. So I called Buzz and I go, Buzz, And he goes, well, we hired that guy. And I said, really? He goes, oh, can I called the guy and I go, when do I get my driver's test? And he goes, well, you didn't get the job. I go, oh. He calls me back. He goes, how did you know? I go, oh, well, when do I get my driver's test? So there you go.
So we want to hear a lot more. In fact, I think it's going to be really interesting to hear about some of your experiences as a fire spotter itself. But you're also coordinating the program, it sounds like.
Well, the program is actually one tower. And it's Sundance Mountain, which I think anybody that's been in Sandpoint for long enough has heard of Sundance Mountain and Sundance Lookout and the Sundance Fire, which happened in 1967. It was a huge fire event. To this day, I think they talk about the Sundance Fire Behavior and Fire Behavioral classes. Well, that was started on Sundance Mountain, and that's where we've had a tower for a long time, the Idaho Department of Lands. And I came back to work one year, and they had closed it for a while, and we really missed it. And my boss said, well, do you want to coordinate volunteers for Sundance? And I said, well, yeah, we need somebody up there. And he goes, okay. So that was about, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe. And since then, developed this program where people come and they stay for at least a week. I want at least a week, especially if I have to train them to how to be a lookout. And then they come and they be a lookout. So it's kind of like going to the rentals, except you're not renting. You have to work. You get the binoculars, you get the firefinder, you get the radio, you get the responsibility of surveillance, detection, reporting, and doing the job of being a fire lookout.
So and that's you get a chance to try and Pam, and you get a chance to try out what it's like to be a fire spotter without having to take on the responsibility for an entire season. What a great program.
It's a great program and a perfect location where it's mostly needed. One of the interesting things that has a parallel to this year about the Sundance Fire is that it was a contained fire. It was a relatively small area with 100% perimeter containment, like a couple of our local fires were. And then the winds blew up, like a couple of our local fires had happened. And then it jumped the fire lines. And because of a big wind event, spread very rapidly. So it is the reason that it's so important to still have continued vigilance over the terrain, even after fires have broken out.
Yeah, how interesting. Hey, Pam, tell us about your work in the tower and about how many folks are able to work in towers these days.
Well, I would encourage everybody to look up the Forest Fire Lookout Association website, and it's got a lot of links to what towers there are, what towers are still staffed, what towers have been torn down. There are not very many left, although it's interesting. This Priest Lake Basin, where I've been working, when I first started, we had six towers around the perimeter of the basin. Right now, we're only working three of them. The one that I had was torn down, and then the couple of them are, they need some repairs, I guess. And but the fire managers still value the presence of a person up there 24/7 doing the detection.
And why is that?
Well, it's... And, but then you have other places that think, well, we can use cameras or we can use planes all the time. Well, it like I say, it's pretty much, it seems to me anyway, site specific. The managers in a certain place value it or they don't. They value something else. Our particular area has seen the benefit of having somebody up there. I just talked to a fire manager today and she was wonderful. I said, you know, it's great to finally meet you because she's from another district, but I hear her on the radio sometimes. And she goes, yeah, she says, we're always kind of envious because you guys have the lookouts. I said, well, put more up, you know? And I said, one of my volunteers a couple years ago said, well, you know, I didn't find any smokes and I feel really bad about that. I said, well, there were no smokes, so don't feel bad about it. But you know what else is really wonderful about it is that the fire managers get some sleep at night. They know they don't have a smoke. They know they don't have to be on high alert because they don't know what's out there. If somebody's up, they get that benefit. So what happened is, this is part of my story, and you can find this on all the Fire Force Lookout stuff or Forest Fire Lookout links and all that. But they had, a couple years ago, Wisconsin tore down all their fire, or they demobilized them. There was no more they were not going to use them anymore. The same year, Pennsylvania decided it was a benefit. So Pennsylvania is putting all these up and Wisconsin's bringing them all down. It's been a discussion with fire managers for a long time. Lookouts are pretty cheap, really, when you think about what it costs for a big heavy helicopter for dropping water on a fire that nobody detected for a week. So that's my spiel about it. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, I think we got the answers to a few different questions in there and it probably opened up a whole lot more. tell us about some of the differences maybe in our region or how things have changed over time. What makes it of a value here, do you think, whereas it might not be as highly regarded elsewhere?
You know, I can't get into that really. Okay. You know, that's going above my pay grade and all that. I might be the highest in the sky, but I'm really the lowest on the totem pole, if you want to put it that way.
Sure.
For me. I mean, I think it's important, but, you know, it's my job. And
how's your experience changed over the years? What differences have you noticed in what you do?
You know, I'm not really sure. I mean, the fire finder is still the same. It's the big compass in the middle of the room. We still report it by the azimuth that we get. There is a lot more electronic kind of tools that we have. Like this morning, as I was coming down, I stopped at the office and they've got new iPads with these great mapping systems. Well, you know, I'd really like one of those because sometimes looking at these maps, it's really hard to tell when you're looking at the terrain what's on the map. That's just how good the maps are. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe I could try that. That would be really more helpful for me to be able to direct people or identify the location of the fire so the responders can get there more easily without having to sniff and beat the bushes and try to find it.
Yeah, makes sense. So tell us what a typical week, Pam, what's a week in the fire spotting world look like? Tell us what that looks like. You come home, don't you? And then you go back out.
I just got home, as you might be able to tell by my picture in the Zoom. You know, every week is different. I think some people either say, well, I could do that, or they go, no, I couldn't, I wouldn't even want to do that. You know, I get that. That's all or nothing. And it is kind of all or nothing on the job. I mean, some days, you know, I can read a book. This week I was pretty socked in with smoke some of the days. So, I mean, I kind of relaxed and did my puzzle and peered out through the smoke a bit and tried not to breathe too deeply. And then two nights ago, I sat through one of the biggest lightning storms I've ever sat through. And it was really something. And everything is going full bore when something like that is happening. It's really amazing to see that power.
When you're deployed, when you go up, how long are you up for?
Well, it varies. Usually I come down Thursdays and I go back up Sundays. But depending upon the season, we try to have somebody in there the whole time. Like somebody may go up and relieve me from the district and just be up there. But we do have a couple other towers up, so we're sitting pretty good and the forecast is looking all right. And right now, because of that big lightning storm, we've got a lot of air there. And so they're going to spot something if they're flying around. Actually, I just got a text from one of the fire managers that said they picked up one of my smokes.
And you know, that's a term that is unique a little bit. It's smoke, that must mean you see what, a little smoky something somewhere?
Well, hopefully it's a little smoky something. We don't want to see too big of a smoky something because that means a lot of work and you don't want to lose ground. You don't want to lose, there are a lot of houses out there now too. And so people are getting nervous and rightly so. They've got to be careful. We've got a lot of fire restrictions in place right now. And the loggers are awesome. They are really careful about the time and watching their equipment. And I mean, their livelihood depends upon having trees in the forest. So they're trying to keep them up and green and healthy too.
So you work for Idaho Department of Lands. You mentioned the other program with the Forest Service. And anyone who's lived here any length of time knows the Priest Lake basin area is a mixture, sometimes a checkerboard mixture, sometimes bigger blocks of both Department of Lands and Forest Service and private property. You're not just looking at the purple sections on the map, the Department of Lands, you're looking at the whole landscape. Or are you focusing on particular lands that are in your jurisdiction?
Well, we call everything we can see. It doesn't, you know, fire doesn't know political boundaries. It doesn't care. It's going to burn starting wherever it starts and go to wherever it can go. So our goal is to detect them and report them. It doesn't matter whose ground it is. I mean, they can figure that out. They can figure out who their host agency, or if it's private ground, who that's going to be. What my job is to see them and call them.
Right. So does it funnel to a common communications network or system, or how do they coordinate? How do you or they coordinate with each other?
Well, we report to the, even though we have separate employers, or, you know, whoever reports, it goes, the wildland fire suppression goes to the Coeur d'Alene Interagency Dispatch Center. And they have a wonderful website, and they have some really good links there. And if anybody's interested, you could find out more about, for one thing, what the open incidents are and where they are, if you have any worries about what is going on out there. And I know that the Bonner County Sheriff does these NICSLE. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Those are wonderful and really helpful, I think, for people just to know what's going on there. I mean, for one thing, nobody can see very far, including me this week. And so you want to kind of know what's going on. They've been doing a really good job, I think.
And I'd like to pause there for a second. The NICSLE alerts, NIXLE, are part of a nationwide system administered by each county's sheriff's department, but they do provide emergency alerts for a range of different situations, catastrophes, disasters, car accidents, fire. And it's so easy to sign up. You can Google it and go to the website, sign up by zip code that you're interested in. You can get text alerts, you can get emails, I think you can even get phone calls, or you can get some combination thereof. And particularly in a stressful situation like this summer, with things that evolve so rapidly, I'd encourage everyone to sign up for the NICSLE alerts of some form in their area.
Yeah, I'd agree, except that you can get so dang many of them, Phil. Sometimes it seems like it's one NICSLE after another, but it's been a very busy year for NICSLE alerts.
And for that reason, I do them via text versus email, so my inbox is clogged up.
Yeah. I know, I'm just looking at mine. Ooh.
Well, Pam, let's move on to just the way this year is happening and how it's different from other years, and maybe you could compare it to other really fiery summers. How is the year going for you? Are you getting any sleep?
Yeah. I mean, when it's not a big lightning storm where I have to sit in my chair, it's been fine. And that was just the other night. I think that this year, and I think anybody will tell you that who is paying at all any attention to what's going on, is that it's way dry, the driest we've seen in a long time. And the fuels are cured up. They're ready to go. That lightning storm that I sat through the other night, instant ignition on the lightning bolts. I mean, there's no coking around in there for a week or two. It's like lighting a match. It just goes. And so it's really dry. So this year is going to go down as one of those for sure. We've had dry years before, but not this early that I recall. So this is a pretty important year, and I hope people are paying attention, and I hope they're being careful.
Yeah. Does your department or the Forest Service, does anybody make predictions for what's going to happen for the rest of the season, or is it anybody's guess?
Well, I think, you know, we're weather and climate data dependent, and you know, we used to say, ask people, say, well, what's the fire season going to be like? We say, well, ask us in October, because we don't know. I mean, I got some rain the other night with that lightning, which I don't know if it slowed it down one bit. As I'm driving off the tower, I can see dust coming up behind the truck, and I'm thinking, oh, well, that really helped a lot. It used to be a tenth of an inch of rain was called a wetting rain, which was a good thing. I got 0.16. Didn't slow the dust down, and I don't think it's slowing down the fire. It might slow down the spread a tiny bit, but it's so dry and hot. We're, you know, it's a really it's just a dry year, and to be really careful. I want to really encourage people to pay attention to that.
And it's still so early in the fire season that nobody really knows, although the goal for most fire suppression management at this point is to keep it contained until the fall rains put things out, I think.
Well, and yeah. then, you know, I'm not a fire manager, but, you know, I watch them a lot and I hear what's going on. And, you know, I just think, boy, I sure wouldn't want that job right now, because then you've got the resource scarcity happening too, with all the demand. What do? You want to smash it, put it out so those resources can be available for the next one. I mean, there's all these kind of things that have to be considered and make it hard, I think, for anybody, especially when you're looking at what's August 5th today. Yeah, it can be, we got a little bit of a stretch ahead of us. We got to be
On a related topic, for the last year and a half now, we've been dealing with the COVID pandemic and restrictions it's put into place on things. How has that shaped your summer this year and last year?
Well, I think being a lookout, I'm kind of out of that loop, which is, I'm okay with that. Okay. people are careful. I think they're being careful in fire camp, and that can be a hard thing. For me on the tower, not so much, not at all. I always ask people that if people are visiting or, you know, berry picking around, and they say, oh, can we come up? And I go, well, are you healthy? And if you have a firearm, leave it at the bottom. That's kind of my rule.
Hey, that's your prerogative, I say.
Yes. It definitely is. It's my house while I'm there.
That's right. So, you know, Pam, where do you see the future of fire spotting? You think it's going to sort of hang in there, or do you think it's a job that's going to slowly dwindle and die away?
Well, that's what's been happening, is that the towers have been coming out. But, you know, like, if it's, like I say, it just depends upon the local management, what they want to do, where they want to put their resources. If the state of Idaho decides that they could put a tower up for not that much money compared to what a suppression effort's going to cost on a big fire, it's not my call. I mean, I love my job, and I love being up there, and I know that other people would like to do it. And the more towers we have, the more people are able to do it, the more people can be on the mountaintop. I think it's a good thing, but that's my personal opinion, and that's my personal experience.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say, it'll only be the passing of an era when it's gone completely. And until then, it's something that I think a lot of people's fascinations are captured by it. And a number of people I know personally have had enough moments of reflection and solitude that it fuels some of their artistic endeavors. And so there's this real human component to it that'll be lost.
There's a group of Idaho, University of Idaho graduate students that are doing a project about that very thing right now. And I'll ship you guys that link, and you might want to talk to them about what they're collecting. But they've gone around, and they're talking to a lot of different lookouts. And they interviewed me about a month ago, and it was really interesting. They're trying to put this, they call it there's some word for it. I'm sorry, I can't think of it right now. Some kind of deep history project. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but I'll ship that to you, email, and you might be interested in talking to those folks. It was interesting to me.
Very definitely. We'll look for that from you. But before you were going to come on and talk with us, I was, of course, thinking about the artistic possibilities for your time in the fire spotting tower. And of course, everything's Google, but the authors' names that came up for folks that have spent time in fire towers are Jack Kerouac, Norman McLean, Gary Snyder, Edward Abbey, some very wonderful writers have benefited from time in the tower.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine all of those writers and poets being how they would be if they didn't have the experience. It certainly changed them in their perspective. So, and it's hard to imagine anyone writing poetry about GIS imagery from satellites.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think. I remember one time I was at a conference. It was in Oregon somewhere, a lookout conference, which is kind of funny, you know, but because we don't usually gather, but we gather once in a while. And we went to this place where Oregon decided they were all in favor of cameras, and they used some of their they're lookouts for camera mounts. And so we visited the place where, here's this room, there's no windows, it's all lined with monitors, three walls of monitors, and there's people in there watching these monitors, and I'm thinking, I would die. That would be so horrible to me. So, I mean, it's different for everybody, but for me, no, I got to be out there. I got to, you know, I had Western tanagers this week. It was really cool.
That's cool. Well,
you've reflected on a few positive things. What's, if you had a couple favorite stories from your time there, things that have been most interesting or impactful to you?
Well, sitting in that chair the other night was pretty impactful. It was just the energy with that lightning coming down around me and the noise and being in that tower just surrounded by that light. I don't know if that's describable so much as just sitting there and feeling all that juice, basically. I mean, I didn't get electrical current, but I feel this power of all this lightning and just the sky's opening up and we got a little bit of rain, but it was still that. And it's happened a couple of times where those really violent storms are, you don't forget those. And then just people experiences a lot, which is really interesting to me that some people, you know, they come up and they go, like I said, either they go, oh, I want this job, or, oh, how do you do this? What do you do? You know, and it's like, well, you know, it's not for everybody, I think, but I'll never forget this one lady. And she, I don't know why she keeps coming back to me, but she had hiked in, she and her husband and maybe a couple of friends. And she was probably, I don't know, mid 30s or something like that. But she wanted to go up on the tower, but she was terrified of going up. I mean, this tower is only like 25 feet off the ground, but you know, it's a big rock and there's a big view. And, you know, she was scared. She was totally scared. And I said, well, do you really want to do it? She says, yes, I hiked all this way. I really want to go up there. I said, well, you know, I'll help you. So, you know, I had her follow me up the stairs and she was shaking so hard. The entire tower, this metal structure was shaking. It was vibrating. And I'm thinking, wow, she's really scared, but she did it. And then her joy and her feeling of success just was so big when she got to the top. And when she was standing there, it was like, wow, you did it. And she was so proud and it was so cool. And so times like that to me, they're big moments for some people. And it's really cool to be able to watch that and be part of that.
Yeah, that's a great story. Hey, I've got to share one now that you're sharing one. Pam, you and I both grew up in Minnesota, and we had a little family cabin north of Brainerd, and there was an abandoned fire tower that looked out over Gull Lake. It was at a ski resort named Ski Gull, and that was abandoned. And so, and it was 100-foot high tower, and it had been abandoned for a while. So there were missing steps and stairs. And so you'd sometimes have to kind of clamber over the missing step. And we as a family would walk up there every summer. And I remember when I was maybe 7 or 8 going up and just being terrified, the missing steps and getting up there. But same thing, you'd get up in that tower and it was just totally magnificent. So I relate to that story. That's a great one.
They're stunning places. And so we've got to ask you the question we always ask of folks who spend a lot of times out in the woods. Any Bigfoot sightings that you can share with us?
No, but I had a really weird thing happen last year.
Okay.
You want to know about that?
We want to know about it.
Sure.
So I get there to this tower and I'm up there and I come down the next day. I'm going to go out to the truck and get more stuff. It's my first trip in. So I'm taking 2 loads. I'm trying to be smart and not pack the big weight one time. And I noticed my walking stick was at the other side of the tower or other side of the steps. I know I put it. I always put it once, you know, that's my hand. I put it there and I came down. It was on the other side. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that's about. So I go down and I come back up and then I get there and there's this kind of rock in the, There was a dime and a quarter and a penny on the steps of the tower, just kind of at the bottom. And I thought, well, how'd that get there? And I thought, wow, that's weird. And I hadn't heard anybody at night. Nobody had come up. I mean, this is not an easy tower to get to for most people. And I thought, wow. So the next day I go down and I'm walking around. I don't know what I'm doing down there. I'm just on the ground. And there's this rock in front of the stairs. And I thought, well, I got to move that rock. That's, you know, I can trip on that. I moved the rock, and under the rock was another quarter and another dime and another penny. I'm thinking, what is going on? I still don't know.
Oh, well,
nobody has confessed. Well, it would have to have been at night. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. So anybody know anything about 36 cents being a Sasquatch number?
Let's put that out to the listeners. KRSY listeners, if you know who that was, call us.
Leave more money next. That'd be good.
There are some things that are just better left unexplained.
That's kind of, yeah, good idea.
There we go. The
explanation would deflate you.
It's okay.
Well,
I think this is a good stopping point. We've had a great interview, and this has been so interesting, Pam.
Thank you for inviting me. I want everybody to be careful with fire and really, really know that there's a lot of people out there busting their butt and really doing a good job for you. And everybody can be on the page, and I would appreciate that.
Support your wildland firefighters, sign up for NCSL, and for details on current fire status, the best resource is the NC website, mm-hmm. intergovernmental agency site. If you've missed any or part of the show or simply want to listen to it again, we will have this available as a podcast in not too many hours after it's played, up on our website at krfy.org. And you can join Julie and I every Tuesday morning, except when we're on hiatus, for another community conversation. Hopefully the Delta variant dies down and we'll have in-studio guests back in the not too distant future and doing live interviews. Until then, we continue to record them for your pleasure and our pleasure and everyone's safety. Tune in again to 88.5 FM, Tuesday mornings, 8 a.m., or live stream us at krfy.org. Thank you.